We are diving right into the manuscript for Philosophy and World Problems, specifically looking at the structural integrity of Volume 2, the Encyclopedia of Life Support Systems.
Right, and just to quickly recap for everyone, this is a massive multi-volume philosophical entry arguing that the global market operates on a life-blind logic that systematically destroys life support systems, and it proposes a new life value onto axiology to correct it.
The foundational terminology here, specifically the concepts of ontoaxiology and the money sequence system, creates an immediate barrier to entry that risks alienating the very audience that needs to understand this crisis.
I have to play devil's advocate here for just a second. This is, at its core, a philosophical work. Ontoaxiology is a legitimate field. It's the study of value and being. If the author just dumbs that down, don't they risk losing the academic rigor that makes this an encyclopedia in the first place?
That's the classic tension, isn't it? But the fundamental weakness in the text right now is that it relies on specialized, almost hermetic language. Terms like the money sequence system disorder in chapter 9.10 or the ontoaxiology of competition. They appear repeatedly, and while they are philosophically precise, they feel incredibly abstract and detached.
It does feel a bit like you need a secret handshake to get past the table of contents.
Exactly. The text risks preaching only to the choir of academic philosophers. But if you look at the title, World Problems, it implies an audience of policymakers, maybe environmental scientists, general citizens. The central argument is that the current system is life blind, but the text itself is currently layman blind.
Right, but how do we keep the precision without the isolation? Because we can't just go in and delete the terms entirely. They are the actual bedrock of the whole theory.
You don't delete them, you earn them. The suggestion for improvement here is to ground the philosophical jargon in visceral, physical reality before introducing the abstract term. The text needs to be inductive rather than deductive. Start with the bleeding wound and then name the weapon.
I like that. Start with the wound. Can you give me a concrete example of what that looks like on the page for this specific manuscript?
Let's look at section 9.3. The life-blind logic of the ruling economic mechanism.
Even that title is quite a mouthful.
It is, and currently, the text opens that section with a direct, abstract definition of that mechanism. Instead, the author should describe a specific instance of life-blindness. Describe the destruction of a water table for industrial output. Focus on the toxic runoff, the drying wells, the tangible loss of a vital life support system.
So you force the reader to basically look at the dead fish and the poisoned water first.
Precisely. You make them feel the actual blindness of the system. You show how the system registered the profit from the factory, but completely failed to register the death of the water. Once the reader is nodding and saying, yes, that is a structural disaster, then you drop the terminology. You say, this is the money sequence system at work.
I see. So the term becomes a relief. It becomes a specialized tool to organize the chaos you've just made them visualize, rather than an initial hurdle they have to jump over.
Right. It validates the reader's intuition instead of testing their vocabulary. Let's look at another concrete example. Chapter 12, Reclaiming Rationality, the Life Coherence Principle. Right now, the introduction abstractly defines what life coherence means in a vacuum.
Yeah, it reads a bit like a geometry textbook right now, just pure axioms.
So the fix is to contrast a rational economic decision, say, a corporation firing 5,000 workers to artificially boost their quarterly stock price, with the coherent biological reality of that action. Describe the actual cortisol spikes in those fired workers, the stress, the loss of shelter, the physical degradation of their health.
Ah, so you pit the economic logic directly against the biological logic.
Exactly. You show that what is perfectly rational for the market is entirely incoherent for the living organism. You make life value mean breath, water, and shelter before you ever ask it to mean an ontological necessity. If you do that, the reader will follow you into the deepest theory you have.
That bridges the gap really nicely. But that actually brings up a second issue I struggled with during the read, which is the overall voice of the text. Because you mentioned this is an encyclopedia, but at times it feels like I'm reading a pamphlet being handed out at a protest.
The manuscript struggles with an identity crisis between being an objective encyclopedia of life support systems and a polemical manifesto against global capitalism.
Yeah, I was looking at chapter titles like The Mass Homicidal Method in section 9.9.2 or System Cooked Science in 12.10. Those are incredibly high-heat phrases.
They are absolutely radioactive. And look, the underlying weakness here isn't the author's passion. The subject matter involves the literal destruction of the planet. Anger is a completely natural response. But the tone often veers into high-heat advocacy, which undermines the authority expected of an encyclopedia. It suggests a conclusion has already been reached rather than an exploration being conducted.
Because it looks like you've already made up your mind before you've presented the reader with the evidence.
Exactly. When a skeptic, say, an institutional economist or a policy wonk, sees a phrase like the cancer stage of capitalism, they don't see a rigorous philosophical argument. They see bias. This rhetorical intensity allows them to dismiss all the incredibly valid philosophical points as mere ideology.
So how do we maintain the urgency of this crisis without sounding like we're just standing on a soapbox? The author clearly wants to sound the alarm.
The suggestion is to adopt a forensic tone rather than a prosecutorial one. A prosecutor screams at the jury. A forensic analyst just points quietly at the blood spatter. Let the evidence of the system's blindness damn the system rather than the adjectives used to describe it.
Forensic, not prosecutorial. That's a great editorial lens. How do we apply that practically? Let's take section 11.5. The current title is, "The Unseen War Goods for Corporate Persons Are Bads for Human Persons."
That title basically screams, "I'm attacking you." Let's reframe the entire argument. Structure it as a comparative analysis. Change the title to something like, "A Comparative Legal Analysis of Corporate versus Human Rights Protections."
I mean, that sounds significantly drier.
It sounds boring, and that is exactly its weapon. Because then, inside the chapter, you lay out the actual legal statutes. You show, mechanically, how corporate property rights legally supersede the human right to water in international trade courts. You show the disparity in legal standing without ever using the war metaphor.
So by the end of the chapter, the reader is the one who realizes, my God, this is an actual war.
Yes. But they came to that conclusion on their own. You didn't force feed it to them on page one. The conclusion feels inevitable and scientifically robust because it was built on dry legal analysis, not rhetorical flourishes.
It's the difference between telling someone a building is on fire and just showing them the temperature gauge hitting 1,000 degrees.
Exactly. Let's look at another example of this tone shift. Section 10.7, Understanding the False Justifications of Money Capital Right. The word false right there in the header is a judgment. It immediately puts the reader on the defensive if they happen to agree with or even just understand those standard economic justifications.
So instead of false justifications, maybe we change it to historical justifications and their logical inconsistencies.
Perfect. That phrasing invites the reader to sit down with the author and dismantle John Locke's provisos together. You are exploring whether logic breaks down historically rather than being told up front, you are wrong and I am right. It turns the reader into an active participant in the logic rather than a passive recipient of dogma.
That is a subtle shift in phrasing, but it changes the entire power dynamic of the book. It treats the reader like an intellectual equal. However, and this is a big however, even if we fix the tone, I felt like I was running in circles regarding the actual structural content. I read volumes 1, 2, and 3, and I swear I read the exact same chapter 3 times.
The central conflict, money value versus life value, is restated with insufficient variation across the 3 volumes, leading to severe reader fatigue and conceptual stagnation.
It really felt like an academic treadmill. Because Chapter 9 discusses the lost social subject. Chapter 10 is deep principles of justice. Chapter 11 is the unseen global war of rights systems. But when I drill down into the actual text, they all fundamentally iterate the exact same point. The money sequence overrides life requirements.
The weakness is the structural circularity. For example, Section 9.4.2 discusses private profit versus civil commons. And then we get to Section 11.3, and it discusses life value versus money value growth. It's the same monster, just viewed from slightly different angles. The narrative isn't moving forward. The reader feels stuck in a loop.
But isn't the author's point that this conflict is the central problem of our global system? They have to hammer it home.
You can hammer it home without hitting the exact same nail in the exact same spot. The suggestion for improvement here is to structure the chapters to build a linear narrative arc: diagnosis, then etiology, then prognosis, then cure. Ensure each chapter tackles a distinct mechanism of the problem, not just a restatement of the problem itself.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that. How do we actually restructure Volume 2 so it flows linearly?
First, dedicate Volume 2, Chapter 9, exclusively to the mechanism of life blindness. Just how the system filters out life data. How does the blindness actually function mechanically?
So, strictly diagnostic, no solutions yet.
No solutions. And that means we have to strip out all mentions of the civil commons here. Currently, the civil commons, which is the author's big overarching solution, is scattered across sections 9.2, 9.4, and 11.7. It completely dilutes the impact of the solution.
So we just move all the civil commons material to the end of the book?
Yes, consolidated all into a single dedicated section called The Solution or The Alternative. This creates a massive narrative payoff. You weigh the reader down with the sheer gravity of the problem, the life blindness, for 10 chapters. And then, just when they feel like the situation is hopeless, you offer the consolidated hope of the civil commons.
That creates actual narrative suspense in a philosophy book, which is incredibly rare. What about chapters 10 and 11 then, the justice and rights chapters? Because they really felt like they were bleeding into each other.
We need to cleanly separate them. Make Chapter 10 purely about the philosophical history. Discuss Confucian ethics, Aristotle, John Locke. Make it a forensic history of how the concept of justice lost its way.
So Chapter 10 focuses entirely on the idea.
Right. And then make Chapter 11 purely about the legal machinery, corporate personhood, international trade laws, the WTO. It becomes the idea versus the machine. Currently, they are tangled up. But if you separate them, the critique becomes much sharper. You show how the bad philosophy in Chapter 10 literally built the bad machine in Chapter 11.
That makes total sense. It stops the conceptual bleeding. But speaking of jarring transitions, there is one more massive shift in this text we have to address, and that's the inner life sections.
The transition from hard economic critique to the metaphysical inner life in chapters 7 and 13 jars aggressively against the materialist rigor of the earlier sections.
To be completely honest, it gave me whiplash. We go from the money sequence system, which is hard, cold, data-driven economics, straight into the felt side of being and the God of Tolstoy. It felt like two completely different books stapled together.
The weakness here isn't the content itself. The inner life is obviously crucial to any discussion of human value, but the connection is completely missing. The text moves from macroeconomic disorder to the micro dissolution of feeling life. But that link is merely asserted. It isn't mechanically proven. It reads like a spiritual addendum.
It really does. It feels like the author is saying, here is a breakdown of global capitalism, and also make sure you are in touch with your soul. And my worry is that the hard science reader, the economist, or the environmental scientist who has stuck with us through all the rigorous critique of global markets is just going to completely check out the moment we start talking about the infinite within.
Exactly. The suggestion here is to bridge that gap by framing the loss of inner feeling not as a spiritual tragedy, but as a structural necessity for the economic system to function. You have to show that the money sequence actually requires numb subjects.
Wait, unpack that for a second. You mean the system mathematically needs us to be numb?
Think about it. If you truly, viscerally felt the reality of the sweatshop labor that manufactured your shoes, or the destruction of the rainforest that grew the palm oil in your food, could you actually participate in the daily market?
No, I'd be completely paralyzed. I couldn't buy anything.
Exactly. The market mechanism would jam entirely. Therefore, the suppression of the felt side of being, the psychic numbing, isn't just a sad side effect. It is a vital economic input. It is a structural requirement for the money sequence to continue flowing.
That is incredibly dark, but it's brilliant. It takes the spiritual critique and turns it right back into a functional, material critique.
It does. So, as a concrete example, let's look at how to rewrite Section 13.9, Human Consciousness in an Age of Collapse. The author shouldn't just lament that inner life is lost. They need to aggressively argue that the economic system actively manufactures that numbness.
It's not a bug of the system. It's a required product feature.
Correct. And we can do the exact same thing for the intro to Chapter 7, Good and Evil Within. Rewrite it to frame human emotions not just as soft inner states, but as cognitive sensors for life value.
Like a Geiger counter for morality.
That is the perfect analogy. Just as a thermometer reads physical temperature, felt pain or empathy reads life reduction. This keeps the hard scientific framing completely consistent, even when discussing soft emotions. You're effectively telling the skeptical economist, look, we aren't talking about souls here. We are talking about biological data sensors.
And the economic system has intentionally smashed the sensors so we can't read the data.
Exactly. Now you have the hard-nosed scientist nodding along with a chapter on human emotion. It integrates the metaphysical right back into the material analysis without losing any rigor.
That really ties the whole manuscript together. It makes the lifeline thesis apply to our own internal psychology just as much as it applies to the external global market.
It makes the work cohesive. And honestly, that is what this manuscript deserves. It is a monumental effort to redefine the grammar of value in the global system. But right now, the structure and the tone are actively fighting the content.
So, let's wrap this up. We've covered a ton of ground today. What is the actual game plan for the author moving forward?
We have four clear actionable mandates. First, accessibility. Ground the ontoophysiology jargon in physical reality before you name it. Start with the wound, not the medical term. Use the water table example to validate the reader's intuition.
Second, tone. Shift from a prosecutorial manifesto to a forensic encyclopedia. Drop the radioactive adjectives like mass homicidal and war. Let the comparative legal analysis do the heavy lifting.
Third, structure. Stop the conceptual treadmill. Consolidate all the civil commons arguments into a single finale to create narrative payoff. And separate the philosophy of justice from the machinery of rights to create a linear diagnosis to cure arc.
And finally, the inner life integration. Mechanically link those spiritual sections back to the economic critique. Frame human numbness as a systemic requirement for the market to function, and frame emotions as cognitive life value sensors.
If the author can execute those four structural shifts, this won't just be an encyclopedia about world problems. It might actually be a tool to help solve them.
I would absolutely love to read the next draft of this, especially that consolidated civil commons finale.
Me too. We invite the listener to submit that revised draft, particularly the new introduction for Chapter 7 and that consolidated solution section for a follow-up critique. There is absolute brilliance in this text. Let's polish it until it shines.